chapter 12. I got up the next morning before my alarm sounded, lurching out of bed and into the bathroom in a mild panic over all the work I had to do that day. I pulled on a t-shirt that passed the sniff test, barely, and decided I could get away with the same socks I'd had on the day before. I was about to open my throat and tip a bowl of muesli down it when I saw the fat newspaper sitting on the kitchen table where my mom had left it. Thick as a hotel room Bible, the San Francisco Chronicle, a newspaper that had thumped down on our doorstep every Saturday morning since time began. Every Saturday morning. I put down my muesli mid-guzzle and flumped into a kitchen chair, all the get-out-of-the-house adrenaline leaving my body with an almost audible whoosh. 5 minutes later, I was still sitting there, contemplating the question of what I should do with my weekend. The last time I'd had a real weekend was back in high school, and even then, I'd had all that homework. I decided it'd be good to make a big old weekend brunch, something for Mom and Dad, with proper coffee, not the swill they normally drank, brewed up with my little AeroPress. Then I could have a leisurely shower, tidy up my room, stick a load of laundry in the machine, and meander down to Noisebridge and dust off Secret Project X1 and see about getting my 3D printer going in time for next year's Burning Man. It was the best plan I could have made for a change. I did crazy-ass 3D pancake sculptures. I cook a mean pancake at. And the coffee was brilliant, a direct quote from my mom. The parents were duly impressed with my room cleaning, and by the time I shoved Lurch into my backpack and jumped on my bike, I was feeling like maybe I'd found some of that normal I'd been missing. There weren't too many Noisebridgers around by the time I rolled in at 10:30. I went to my shelf and grabbed down my box of stuff, making puffs of playa dust rise off all the broken crap I'd brought back from Burning Man. I found a free workbench and nodded at the girl with the shaved head who was teaching her little sister how to solder at the next bench over. I got a can of compressed air and some soft cloths and started blowing out the dust and getting ready to wrestle with my printer anew. I slipped into an easy reverie, punctuated by clubmate breaks, this being the official drink of hackerspaces around the world, a sweet German soda laced with caffeine and mate tea extract, a jet fuel-grade stimulant. When the cleaning was done, I grabbed a multimeter and started testing all the circuits in X1, starting from the power supply and working my way through the system. Partway through my checks, I thought I found the problem, a spot where it looked like a stepper motor had been mounted backwards. So I grabbed Lurch and went hunting for a diagram to see if I was right, thinking, geez, if it turns out that this was all that was wrong, I'm going to feel like a total derp. Of course, once my laptop was open on the workbench beside me, it was inevitable that I'd have a sneaky peek at my email. Looking at my laptop without checking in would be like going to the cupboard and not snagging a cookie. 2. Marcus Yallo at pirateparty.org.se. From Leaky McLeakerpants. Subject, Carrie Johnstone Docs. To use as you see fit. It was signed with a little ASCII art Guy Fawkes face made out of punctuation marks and letters, and attached to the email was a gigantic zip file. I had a pretty good idea what that was. Every single fact and fantasy that could be had about Carrie Johnstone and what she was up to. I'd seen doxes that went back to second grade report cards, ones that included the subject's kids' medical records, everything. Nothing was off limits when you were being doxed. I closed my laptop's lid and closed my eyes. A big part of me didn't want to see the docs in that folder. I had plenty of secret docs in my life already, and I knew what it was like to be totally, absolutely invaded. Carrie Johnstone had done it to me. So had the jerks who'd rooted my laptop. Somewhere in the world, someone might be staring at an email whose subject line was Marcus Yallo docs. The thing was, I knew I was going to open that zip file. Of course I was. Who wouldn't? Carrie Johnstone was a monster. Kidnapper, torturer, murderer, war criminal, power-tripping mercenary. Scumbag and commander of scumbags. She was hunting me, too. Let's not forget that. Now that the story was out, wouldn't Ziz be back? How long until I met Timmy and Knothead again? Would I end up at the bottom of the bay this time? I had to open it. It was self-defense. In fact, I bet the only reason Carrie Johnstone hadn't had me whisked away to some private torture chamber was that she assumed that I'd been sneaky enough to gather this kind of dossier and had it ready to dump on a dead man's switch if I got disappeared. People like Carrie Johnstone always assume everyone else thinks like them, not like people like me. People like me are good people. We deserve to read other people's dirty laundry, especially bad people. I was such a coward. I unpacked the folder and started browsing the docs. You would have done it too. Marcus, a voice said some eternity later. It was Lemmy, the noise bridger who'd given me and Ange our ride back from Burning Man. He was in his 40s, an old ex-punk with stretched-out ear piercings and blurred tattoos up and down his arms. He was a demon in the machine shop and was the first person I'd ask any time I had a question about something big, fast-moving, and lethal. I always got the impression that he thought my little electronics projects were cute toys, fun, but not serious like a giant piece of precision-machined metal. I had the feeling he'd been talking to me for a little while and that I hadn't heard him. "Sorry," I said. "Engrossing reading is all." He smiled. "Look, I was going to go join the rest down at the big demonstration, bring some UAVs along. Want to come along and be my crew?" "There's a big demonstration?" He laughed. "Come on, buddy, take a break every now and then, will you? You know that big one that happened yesterday? Well, it looks like everyone who went yesterday has come back again, and they brought all their friends. Downtown's shut down. I've been playing with my quadcopters, think I can get them to produce some killer footage. They're all rigged to act as Wi-Fi bridges, too, each on a different 4G network, so we should be able to supply some free connectivity to the crowd. I've also got a software-defined radio rig and three of them that can triangulate on police and emergency bands. I think I've got it set so they'll home in on any clusters of dense police radio chatter, which should be pretty interesting. But, you know, I'm not really much of a coder, so I thought I could use a pit crew to help me debug the code on the fly during the inaugural flight." Lemmy was also a UAV nut, though, again, I think he'd have preferred unmanned autonomous tanks, or ATVs, or anything with a lot of shiny, heavy metal. I looked at my screen, and my screen looked back at me, with everything I could have ever wanted to know about Carrie Johnstone, and a lot more. I couldn't stop looking at it, but I didn't want to keep looking at it. "Let's go," I said, putting my lid down and sticking Lurch in my bag. "You can't write code for shit, dude." "Yeah," he said cheerfully. "Code's just details. I'm a big picture kind of guy." Lemmy wanted to drive, it being hard to carry four miniature quadcopters the couple of miles to the periphery of the demonstration, but we probably could have crawled in less time than it took to beat the frozen traffic leading up to the march. I spent the time getting familiar with Lemmy's control software, which built on some standard libraries I was already familiar with, systems for steering UAVs and for running software-defined radios, mostly. Software-defined radio is hot stuff, but it's kind of snuck up on the world without us noticing much. Old-fashioned radios work with a little quartz crystal, like the one in an electrical watch. Quartz vibrates, buzzing back and forth at a rate that's determined at the time that it's manufactured. You choose a crystal, build a circuit around it, and the radio is done. It can tune into any signals that are inside the vibrational frequency of the crystal. One radio works for tuning into GPS satellites, another to CDMA cellular phone signals, another for FM radio, and so on. But SDR is programmable radio. Instead of a crystal, it uses a fast analog-to-digital converter, a little electronic gizmo that takes any analog signal off a sensor, say light patterns off an electric eye or sound patterns off a microphone, and turns it into ones and zeros. You connect the converter to a radio antenna and tell it what band to listen in on, and then you use standard software to make sense of what it receives. What this means is that the same box can be used to read air traffic signals, police band, CB radio, analog TV, digital TV, AM radio, FM radio, satellite radio, GPS, baby monitors, 11 flavors of Wi-Fi, and every cellular phone standard ever invented all at once, provided the converter is fast enough, the antenna is big enough, and the software is smart enough. It's the radio wave equivalent of inventing a car that can turn itself into a bicycle, a jumbo jet, a zeppelin, an ocean liner, or a performance motorcycle just by loading different code into its computer. It's badass. Lemmy's UAVs had some off-the-shelf SDRs he'd bought from an open-source hardware company called Adafruit in New York. Adafruit sells electronics that come with full source code and schematics, complete roadmaps for remaking them to do your bidding. Everyone at NoiseBridge loved their SDRs and other gear, and since there were thousands of hackers and tinkerers around the world who worked with the Adafruit SDRs and all the other versions that Adafruit's competition made from the same plans, there was a lot of very clean, very well-documented code for talking to them. I dove into this in the passenger seat, vaguely aware that the car was lurching from stop to start, turning corner after corner as Lemmy sought out a spot close to the protest. "What's the verdict, Doc?" he said as he engaged the parking brake. "Is my code going to live?" I shrugged. "Looks about right to me. Am I right in thinking you've just pasted in the code examples from the tutorials with a couple of lines tying each module in with the last?" He grinned. "Yep. I treat writing code like making cake from a cake mix. Pour it into a bowl, add an egg and a cup of water, stir, and throw it in the oven. It's not always pretty, but it's always a cake." "Well, let's see if we've got a cake then." I got out of the car, a tricky feat since we were parked on the upslope of a steep hill. I didn't immediately recognize the neighborhood, but when I did, I was surprised. "Are we on the other side of Knob Hill?" "Yep, it's the closest I could get to the protest. That thing is huge." "But we must be, I don't know, a mile away?" "Oh, less than that. Plus, the protest is getting bigger, from what I can tell. It might reach here before the day's out." "Something's happening. People are pissed. I've been living here since the 80s, and I've never seen anything on this scale." He dug around in the trunk and pulled out his quadcopters. Each one was an X of light, flexible plastic, with helicopter rotors at the end of each leg of the X. A round pod in the middle carried the battery and the electronics, radios, and control systems. Without the battery, each one weighed less than a pound, but the batteries doubled their weight. He handed me two of them, and I held one in each hand, awkwardly fitting my fingers around the sensors and antennae in the center disc, trying not to bend anything or smudge any of the lens covers. Then he handed me one more, being much rougher with it than I dared to be, but then it was his quadcopter to break, not mine. I stuck it awkwardly under one arm. He perched the remaining one on his hand and thumbed at his phone with his other hand. The four rotors spun up with a dragonfly whirring. The quadcopter wobbled twice on his palm, then lifted off straight into the sky in a vertical takeoff that was so fast it seemed like the quadcopter had simply vanished like a special effect. He took back the extra copter from me and showed me his phone, which was showing the view from the copter's lower camera, a receding landscape with the tops of our heads in the middle of it, shrinking to two little dots as the copter clawed at the air and pulled itself into the sky. "Well, that works," he said. "Thought it'd be useful to have a little overview as we got close. Here, I'm going to webcast the feed." He thumbed some more buttons. "Nice," I said. This was exactly what I loved about technology, when it just worked and turned individuals into forces of nature. We just put an eye in the sky that anyone could tune into. "What's the link?" "It automatically tweets the URL from my account when I start it up. Do you follow me?" "Yeah," I said. I got out my phone and punched up the Twitter client, found the tweet with the link, and retweeted it, tapping in, "Heading to the hashtag San Francisco, hashtag Occupy, hashtag protest. Bringing quadcopters. Aerial video here." We walked laboriously uphill to the top of Knob Hill, the copter hovering 100 feet above us, high enough to be clear of any overhead wires or trees. From Lemmy's phone screen, we could see the hairy edges of the protest, where people were still arriving. Farther in, it looked almost like static. All these little dots, people's heads, moving in tiny quick blips, packed as densely as oranges in an orange crate. "Holy crap," I breathed, as the copter rose higher, revealing the size of the crowd, which spread from Fell Street to Market Street, spilling out over the side streets, filling them back for blocks and blocks. "Damn," Lemmy agreed. "Want to buzz him? Can you do that from here?" "Yeah," he said. "It'll take the copter out of direct radio range, but we'll still get its feet off the net, and we can check out the software, see if it really works." I watched as he tapped out a flight pattern on his phone, tracing a zigzag over the crowd with his fingertip. Then he pressed go. Over our heads, the copter zipped off toward the crowd, keeping its altitude for most of the journey, then gently descending to a mere 5 yards off the ground. At this height, I could make out individual faces in the crowd, read the slogans on the signs. Then the flight path kicked in, and the point of view swerved nauseously, tracing that zigzag with mathematical precision, sometimes shuddering as the copter got caught in a gust of wind. We stopped walking and just watched the feed for a while. I shouted, "Look out!" at the phone's screen when the copter nearly collided with another UAV, this one covered in markings from MSNBC. Either it had some kind of automatic avoidance routine built into it, or there was a fast-fingered human operator nearby, because it banked hard and barely missed the mid-air collision. Lemmy, what happens if that thing crashes? I mean, I don't want to turn someone into hamburger. Well, yeah, me neither. In theory, any two rotors can give it enough lift to slow its descent, and it makes a lot of noise if it goes in for an emergency landing, which should help people get out of the way. Unless it's so noisy that they don't hear it. Yeah, well, that's life in the big city. I wasn't sure I agreed. Crashing the quadcopter into someone's head would really, really suck. On the other hand, the knowledge that this might happen certainly gave watching the footage an air of extreme danger, which made it that much more compelling. As if it wasn't compelling enough, watching the video of all those faces, thousands and thousands of them, ripping past at speed. "Let's get down there," he said, and I agreed. The demonstration was even louder than the one the day before, a roar like a PA stack that I could hear from two blocks away over the honking horns of the cars trying to find their way around it. The sidewalk was too jammed with people to walk, so we joined the hundreds who were threading their way through the stuck cars, dodging the bikes and motorcycles that were doing the same. Soon, we could barely move, and I realized we were now in the demonstration, even though there were stuck cars all around us. I looked in one, saw a harried-looking woman with two little kids in the back seat who were losing their minds, one hitting the other with a toy car, both of them screaming like banshees, silent gaping mouths through the closed windows. I locked eyes with the driver who was looking resigned and frazzled. I wondered about all the other people who were stuck around me, wanting to get home and feed the kids, or get to work and not get docked for being late, or wanting to get to the hospital or the airport. I entertained a brief fantasy of directing traffic, helping all those people get unstuck and turn around and head away from the protest, get moving again, but there was no way I could do that. Later I read reports of other people doing just that, and of crowds making way to help this happen, and I felt both proud of my fellow human beings and ashamed of not having the guts to try it myself at the time. Now we couldn't move without a lot of "excuse me's" shouted into the ears of people who were shouting the same thing into the ears of the people ahead of them. "This is insane," I said. "Pretty amazing," Lemmy said, and smiled hugely. Suddenly, it felt like the world was flipping upside down. It was amazing. Hundreds of thousands, millions of my neighbors and friends had taken over the city of San Francisco because they were pissed off about the same things I was pissed off about. They'd come and put their lives and liberty on the line because stuff was messed up. It wasn't just the darknet docs. It wasn't just the lobbying to make the deal over student loans even worse. It wasn't just the foreclosed houses and all the jobs that had vanished. It wasn't just the planetary devastation and global warming. It wasn't just the foreign dictators we'd propped up or the private prison industry we supported at home. It was all of it. It was the fact that there was all this terrible stuff, and no one seemed to be able to do anything about it. Not our political leaders, not our police, not our army, not our businesses. In fact, a lot of the time, it seemed like politicians, police, soldiers, and businesses were the ones doing the stuff we wanted to put a stop to. And they said things like, "We don't like it either, but it has to be done, right?" Here was a big slice of my city that had turned out to say wrong, to say stop, to say enough. I knew that these were all complicated problems that I couldn't grasp in their entirety, but I also knew that "it's complicated" was often an excuse, not an explanation. It was a way of copping out, saying that nothing further could be done, shrug, let's get back to business as usual. I'd never seen this many people in one place. From the copter's point of view, it was like the city had come to life, the streets turning from lifeless stone and concrete into a living carpet of humanity that stretched on and on and on. It was scary, and I had no idea how it would turn out, but I didn't care. This was what I'd been waiting for. This was the thing that had to happen. No more business as usual. No more shrugging and saying, "What can you do?" From now on, we do something. Not run in circles, scream and shout, but march together, demand a change. I also realized that my stupid idea for what to do next for Joe's campaign wasn't so stupid after all. Lemmy's copters just kept buzzing the crowd, and our Ustream channel kept picking up viewers, up to a couple thousand now. No doubt a lot of them were in that crowd, but plenty were from all over the world, to judge by the real-time stats. Every so often, we'd deploy three copters with the software-defined radio scanners to check for high concentrations of police band chatter. The police had recently started to encrypt their signals, but that didn't matter. We didn't care what they were saying. We only wanted to detect places where a lot of police communications were taking place. In other words, we were interested in the fact that they were talking, not what they were talking about. When the three detected police band spikes, they sent the fourth copter to home in on it and take some video. That way, we caught a lot of footage of arriving convoys of militarized cops and then the National Guard. Hundreds of them and dozens of police buses, the kind they took masses of prisoners away in, and even little clusters of police quadcopters that were sending their signals back and forth in the same encrypted band. Two of these copters latched onto our scout and started to follow it around. "Uh-oh," Lemmy said. "Why uh-oh?" "Well, even with these new power cells, that little guy's gonna run out of battery soon enough, and I'm going to have to bring him in for a fresh power pack, and they're going to know exactly who we are and where we are." "Uh-oh," I agreed. "Is flying a UAV illegal?" He shrugged. "Probably. I mean, no, not in general, but... is there some kind of freaky conspiracy to abet civil disorder BS charge they could womp up against anyone they don't like? I'm pretty sure there is." "Uh-oh," I said again. "I guess I'll just ditch it," he said. "Man, this sucks. How much time is on the power pack?" He looked at the telemetry streaming off the scout. "Maybe 20 minutes? Can you tell it to land somewhere out of the way, maybe a rooftop, and we can try to collect it later?" "Yeah," he said. "Good one." I used Google Earth to scout out the nearby roofs and found a likely-looking spot, which I showed to Lemmy, and he took over steering the scout to it. It was away from the main body of the protest, and who knows what the SFPD crew who were piloting our tails thought we were up to. I got to steer the remaining three, staying away from the police copters. Mostly, I just tried to zoom in on any place where things looked interesting. I found one spot right by Civic Center, where a bunch of parents with small children had made a kind of kindergarten, an open circle of people with a bunch of playing kids in the middle. Boy, that was cool. Made me think that my fellow humans were really basically great. I got a call from Ange, who, of course, was already in the thick of the crowd, blocks away from me within the mass. I told her where I was, and she told me to stay put, and she'd come and meet me. "Okay, we're down," Lemmy said. "You bookmarked that location, right?" "Got it," I said. "Roger that, Mission Control," he said. "Yeah, that." I flicked from one copter feed to the next, watching as a cam soared over our heads, and I saw that we weren't on the edge of the protest anymore. It now stretched for two blocks behind us, and there were lots of people still arriving. I was still taking in this fact when a large, firm hand clamped my shoulder, and I had a momentary panic, sure that this was someone from Ziz come to snatch me out of the crowd. Before I was even conscious of what I was doing, I had started to move into the thick of the crowd, turning sideways to eel my way through the small gaps between bodies. But then a familiar voice said, "Marcus!" And I stopped and turned around. It was Joe Noss, in his usual campaigning clothes, sweater and all. He was grinning like a bandit. "Joe!" I said. "Sorry, you startled me."
I know no one wants to run into the boss on the weekend," he said.
"Isn't this something, then?" It's amazing, I said, thinking as I said it that maybe he wasn't someone who supported this kind of thing and wondering if I'd said the wrong thing. I think it's incredible, right?
Marcus, in all my life, I've never seen anything like this. If there was ever a time to be an independent candidate, it's now. These people are just plain fed up with the way things work in government. And so am I. So there we are, all in this together.
Preach, brother,
Lemmy said, and Joe smiled his thousand-watt smile at him.
Hello there, he said. I'm Joseph Noss.
Oh, I know it. I'm Lemmy. Lemmy's a friend of mine from the hacker space. Joe shook his hand.
What a treat. Marcus has told me about your space. It sounds, well, extraordinary, like you're some kind of superheroes of science. From what he tells me, you folks can build just about anything you set your mind to.
Lemmy nodded vigorously. Yeah, pretty much. And if we can't build it, someone at some other makerspace or hackerspace will help us out. We have a Friday night drop-in. You should come by and see what we're up to.
I'd love that, though perhaps I might have to wait until after Election Day, as I'm a little preoccupied.
He scanned the crowd again.
I can't get over this, he said. All these people.
Look at this, Lemmy said, and showed him the screen.
Is that from one of the news networks? Joe asked.
Lemmy laughed. Yeah, HNN, Hackerspace News Network. It's coming off some unmanned quadcopters I built up there. He pointed at the sky. Joe looked up, looked back at him.
You're joking. You're flying helicopters by remote control?
Oh, they only weigh a couple pounds, and they're the size of dinner plates. Little guys, nothing fancy. Maybe $50 worth of parts in each of them. The most expensive thing in them are the batteries, and I hand-built them from salvaged cell phone battery packs.
Joe put his hands on his hips and cocked his head at Lemmy, as if wondering whether he was pulling his leg. Then he shook his head in admiration.
Incredible, he said. Just amazing.
Want to fly one? Lemmy said, tapping at his screen. There's about 15,000 people watching the feed off this one. Go nuts. Just use the keypad.
Joe looked at the phone in his hand as if it were radioactive.
I don't think I'm qualified to operate an aircraft.
Oh, you're not operating it. It operates itself. You just tell it where to go. I thought Joe was going to balk, but he prodded tentatively at the screen. Then, more forcefully,
amazing, he said, after a little time. Just amazing. What's this red icon flashing for, though?
Lemmy took the phone. Low battery, he said. Better bring the gang in for a battery swap. Luckily, I brought a ton of charged spares. He disappeared down the rabbit hole, all his attention focused on his phone, doing that classic nerd focus thing, radiating a cone of, I'm busy, don't bug me, as his fingers danced. There was something I wanted to tell Joe, but I was scared to. My mouth had dried up, but my palms were wet. The crowd noise around us was loud, but I could still hear my heart in my ears.
Joe, I said. He looked at me with those eyes that seemed to bore straight into my soul.
Yes, Marcus, he said.
His whole body language shifted into a posture of thoughtful listening, one of those politician magic tricks that seemed to set him apart from the rest of us. Part of my mind wondered if he even knew he was doing it, while the rest of my mind was calming down and responding to it. Minds are weird.
I think I've got an idea for your campaign. It's a bit, ambitious, though.
Ambitious is good. I like ambitious.
What if we give our supporters a vote-finding machine, a little app they can run on their PCs? First, it goes through your contacts list on Facebook, Twitter, email, and whatever, and gives you a one-click way to send a message to each person in your neighborhood who you think you could recruit to support your campaign. We could give them some checkboxes for issues that they think each contact cares about and automatically create a pitch note with your positions on each. Every new supporter is then asked to do the same thing with their contacts list. Then we go after everyone in the local campaign donor records, cross-checking to see if any existing supporters have a connection to them that we can use to pitch them for money. And then it moves on to voters and people you could register to vote.
But we don't just use a static pitch. We start with what we think our best talking points are, write several variations, and test them to see which ones perform best. A-B testing, is this one or that one more effective? We can tweak the pitch several times a day if we get enough volume all through the campaign, like polling, but fast. And anyone who recruits a friend gets points. And we do leaderboards and invite the best performers every week to a big beer and pizza party at HQ. Make it all into a game, a championship. Meanwhile, we use mapping software that knows where every voter is to calculate the optimal places to hold events around the state. The press database is blasting them out, and the press is coming because they're actually fun. Instead of sober speeches about random words, they're much more like stand-up or The Daily Show, full of great witty sound bites that work perfectly in an evening newscast or a newspaper story. And because they're so entertaining and always a little different, they bring quite a following. They become events. Joe's eyes were wide.
You can build this?
I shrugged. Probably. I mean, most of it sounds like it's just a quick tweak to some of the free open campaignware out there, but I don't think anyone's done it for elections yet. I could build something, get it running.
So, if you could build it, then my opponents could too?
Can't see why not, but that sounds like a reason for you to build it first. He laughed. I had an idea, though. But I've also been thinking of ways you can use the net that your opponents can't.
Go on.
The same remote part of my mind wondered why he said can't this wait until Monday. But then, he was Joe. He was the candidate. He didn't get weekends. He was here with one of his campaign workers, and that meant that he was, fundamentally, at work. You know the darknet docs, right? It took everything in me not to look around at that moment to see if anyone was watching.
I'm familiar with them, he said.
His face was unreadable, the same mask of listening he'd slipped into when I started talking. Well, they're hard to get at right now. You have to do a lot of stuff with Tor, which is this anonymizing technology that's kind of tricky. On the plus side, it's really hard to take them down or even figure out where they are. On the other hand, they're hard for normal people to go and see. That's because no one's hosting them on a regular, boring old internet site as a collection of documents that anyone with a web browser can see and link to.
Yes, he said. I think that's right. The main reason I didn't go and look at them myself is that it seemed altogether too complicated for someone who wasn't a dedicated techno ninja.
I started to say it's not that hard and was about to launch into a little tutorial about how to use Tor, but I stopped myself. It didn't matter, and besides, if Joe felt like it was too complicated, it was important to acknowledge that he had the right to feel that way. Well, I have looked at these documents, and from what I've seen of them, they're full of corruption, crime, and sleaze. And by and large, this corruption, crime, and sleaze has been committed by the big parties and their pals. So it seems to me that if you want to convince people that they should risk voting for an independent candidate, it'd help if you could show people that they're not wasting their votes when they vote for you, because any other vote is going to give power to the same dirtbags who did all this bad stuff.
You think we should host all the darknet documents, he said.
He didn't look like he thought it was the worst idea in the world, but he also didn't throw his arms up and give me a bear hug and shout, Marcus, you've done it! Yeah.
From what I understand, only a small percentage of these documents have been examined. What if we put all this stuff on our site and it turns out that it's full of lies or dirty jokes or people's bank details?
Damn, I liked Joe. That was a really good question. Well, there's the Darknet spreadsheet, and that lists all the docs that have been combed over by the Darknet team, whoever they are. I made a conscious effort not to look guilty, so we could just slurp those in. I could write a script that checks the spreadsheet several times a day and grabs anything that's been described. He looked thoughtful.
Well, that's better than putting it all up. But Marcus, we don't know who these Darknet people are. What you're talking about is fundamentally giving them the ability to put anything they want on the Jonas campaign site just by adding it to their spreadsheet. That seems like a big step to me, and a big risk.
That was frustratingly true. I hate it when people are right at me. I said, well, what if we set up a requirement that everything has to be looked at by a human in our office before it goes live?
I thought for a moment longer. I could put up all the titles of the docs that we haven't approved yet and let visitors to the site vote for which ones they want reviewed first. So if they start pouring in by the thousands, we'd prioritize the ones that Joe Noss supporters were most interested in. He started nodding midway through this, and by the time I was finished, he was smiling.
That's a very interesting idea. Not at all what I had in mind, I have to say. But it's pretty interesting. Being the best place in the world to find out about the corruption of traditional politics is a smart move for a reforming independent political candidate. And you think you could build this?
I thought about it for a moment or two, mentally sketching out the way I'd stitch together off-the-shelf parts from various software libraries that already existed for Drupal, the industrial-strength system we were using to manage our website. Yeah, I said. It should be pretty straightforward. I've done most of that stuff before. It's just a matter of doing it again, but gluing it together in a different way. He nodded again.
Do it, he said. Do both. Build me a demo, and I'll show it to Floor and my advisory committee. I might get you in to help with that. If they sign off on it, we'll make it happen. Can you have something for Monday?
It was Saturday. Theoretically, I could do this on Sunday. He'd set a demo, right? I could nail up a demo in a couple hours. Yeah, I said, I can do that.
You are my Delta Force ninja, Marcus.
Lemmy straightened up from his work on the quadcopter's batteries and laughed.
That sounds about right.
My phone rang then. It was Ange, lost in the crowd nearby, and I talked her in, waving my hands in the air so she could spot me. She gave me a giant hug, and I introduced her to Joe.
Marcus thinks you're pretty awesome, she said to him by way of hello.
It's entirely mutual, he said.
And the way he said it, it was like he meant it, not like a mere formality. I could actually feel my head swelling.
And I'm sure you're something special, given what I know about him. You should come by our office sometime and say hello. Watch Marcus do his magic.
I'd like that, Ange said. And I could tell she felt the same immediate trust and bond with Noss that I'd felt. It was like magic, scary and wonderful at once. Ange crouched down to say hi to Lemmy and went to work with him getting the quadcopters ready to go again. She'd tuned into our feed, following my tweet, and was itching to do some flying. I could tell that Lemmy would have a hard time getting the controller away from her.
I imagine you go to these all the time, Joe said to me.
I said, not really. Liam and I went to one yesterday, but I have to admit I don't get down to protests very often.
I see, he said. When I was a young man, it seemed like all we did was protest. The Reagan years were pretty turbulent in San Francisco. Haven't been out to many since. I keep wondering when something's going to happen, though. We used to have speeches and such.
Well, I said, you can do a speech if you want. I think a lot of people would like to hear what you have to say. I told him about the People's Mic, which he'd heard of but never seen.
It sounds like a microphone that only works if you can convince the people around you that you've got something to say, he said. I like that.
Want to try? Having been shoved in front of the People's Mic the day before, I was eager to do it to someone else. After all, Joe was a real no-fooling politician, with that spooky ability to make you trust him with a look and a few words. He looked around at the crowd, considering it seriously.
I do believe I would, he said.
Right now? He grinned.
Oh, yes, certainly, before I lose my nerve and go home.
I put my hands around my mouth and, feeling a little self-conscious, hollered, Mic check! A dozen or so people picked up the call. I repeated it, and again, until a few hundred people around us were saying mic check and waiting for Joe to start. Joe, meanwhile, had struck up a conversation with the driver of a nearby parked car, who had climbed out of the driver's seat and perched on the car's bumper.
This gentleman's volunteered the hood of his car for a stage, Joe said.
The driver, an older Asian guy in a sports coat and aviator shades, was looking interested and good-tempered. The whole thing was remarkably cheerful, really, for a gathering of hordes of pissed-off people. We were all in very good spirits. Must have been discovering how many of our neighbors felt the same way we did. Joe stepped nimbly onto the car's hood, wobbled once, caught his balance.
My name is Joe Noss, and I'm running as an independent for the California Senate, but that's not why I'm here today.
This was way too long for the People's Mic, and the words got jumbled in the repetition.
Joe didn't look flustered, just did his thoughtful face again and started over.
Sorry about that.
Sorry about that, the people's mic said.
My name is Joseph Noss. I am running as an independent candidate for the California Senate. I could have had the party nomination from the Democrats, and probably from the Republicans. But I decided to go independent. Even though everyone says you can't win in this country unless you're part of a party. And they may be right. But I've been a Democrat all my life. And the spying, the wars, the banksterism, it's not the Democratic Party I joined. And the Republicans don't offer anything better. Because there's something wrong with our country. There's something wrong with our world. Somehow, the ideals of fairness, neighborliness, and justice have vanished, to be replaced by a cult of greed, short-sightedness, and whatever you can get away with.
He had the rolling tones of a preacher and a voice like a bullhorn. He had to wait a long time between sentences because there were rings and rings of people repeating his words far down the street in every direction. The guy whose car he was standing on wasn't looking mildly amused anymore. He was looking enraptured. After every sentence, while he was waiting for the mic to finish, he had a look on his face of serene confidence.
I don't have the answer. I don't think anyone has the answer. But I think we're only going to find the answer when we stop making it all worse. We need politicians who stand for people, not money, which is what I have been and what I plan on being. We have an office on Mission Street, right by 24th. It's open every weekday. You can drop in anytime. Tell us what you hope for from your government, and we'll tell you what we plan on doing. And you can visit our website, of course. Just Google Joe Noss.
He flashed me a smile. I noticed that he always made a point of spelling out www.josephnossforcaliforniasenate.org every time he finished his speeches, which made him sound like a time traveler from the 1990s, and I'd pointed out that he was the top three results for his own name on every search engine.
Thank you!
He got a lot of people's mic-style cheers. Fingers wiggling in the air so as not to drown out the speaker, and people crushed in around him as he stepped down and thanked the guy whose car he'd been using. The guy gave him a surprise hug. This was California, after all, and Joe took it like a pro and gave him a hearty, back-slapping bear hug in return.
That was most remarkable, Marcus, he said. Thank you for that opportunity.
You did great, I said, feeling a little silly telling this guy who was a total pro that he'd done well by the lights of a pipsqueak like me, but he seemed genuinely happy. We chatted a while longer, and then someone else stood up and did a people's mic about her student debts, which had grown by over $200,000 in fines and penalties when the loan company lost one of her payments. There were a few more of these, and I was getting hungry. Ange had some cold pizza and tinfoil in her pack, so we moved off a ways and ate, and when we rejoined Lemmy, Joe was gone. Said he wanted to see what was happening elsewhere, Lemmy said. Seems like a good guy. He is, I said, vicariously proud to have been the guy who introduced Joe to Lemmy. Crowds have moods, like people, and these moods are more than the sum of the moods of everyone in the crowd. It's possible to be a happy person in an angry crowd, but not for long. Because either you leave or you get angry yourself. The mood of the crowd when we arrived had been happy, if a little nervous. As the day wore on and the crowds grew and grew, the mood got more excited, with tinges of, holy crap, can you believe this? And, man, we should do something. And, how long are we going to get away with this? The three of us, Lemmy, Ange, and me, moved around some, getting deeper into the crowd and then off into its sub-branches, using the copters to spot places where interesting stuff was happening. We visited a place where a marching band was playing ragtime and people were dancing and whooping. Another where a gigantic group of drummers were beating out a wall of polyrhythmic sound. A few makeshift stages where people's mic talks were going on. One was a really interesting talk about the Federal Reserve, the other an embarrassing conspiracy theory about the government being secretly behind the bombing of the Bay Bridge. The speaker claimed he'd worked on the rebuilding project and had been officially secretly told not to save anything that might help figure out who was behind the attack. I'd heard that theory a few times, and it just didn't hang together. It seemed like the kind of thing you'd only believe in if you were looking for an excuse to distrust the government. I didn't need any excuse to distrust the government. I didn't need to speculate about the unlikely possibility that they'd blown up the Bay Bridge to find a reason to believe that there were people in power who were just waiting for the chance to set up a police state. I distrusted the government because when the Bay Bridge blew, the city of San Francisco became a police state in the space of hours. Either that meant that some evil genius had attacked the Bay Bridge in order to send in all his authoritarian thug henchmen, or it meant that there were people out there who were just waiting for any disaster, standing by with a whole well-developed plan for unleashing their goons on people who've just lived through some kind of terrible emergency. Call me a skeptic, but I think it's even creepier to see someone who's just suffered disaster and think, hey, great, they're vulnerable, and I can screw them over, than to actually plan the disaster. So I just don't see the point in trying to make some kind of case proving that the Bay Bridge was an inside job. It's ever so much more evil if it wasn't an inside job. Thinking this stuff, talking it over with Ange, I started to feel like somehow the crowd's mood was changing. It was getting dark, and the temperature was dropping. It had started off as one of those San Francisco September days that are as hot as a July day anywhere else, but it was turning into one of those foggy San Francisco nights that makes you cold right to your marrow. The day's excitement was giving way to more anger and more fear, and it seemed to me that I was hearing a lot more crackling police radios, seeing a lot more helicopters and UAVs overhead. We were stopped in a particularly dense spot near McAllister Street, so I got out my phone and watched Lemmy's copter's point of view for a little while. There were a lot more cops, it was true. One of the copters was off at the fringe of the protest, and as it swung around, I saw a line of police and military buses stretching out to infinity, seemingly all the way to the Embarcadero. Either those buses were there to bring about a zillion cops to the protest, or they were there to take a zillion protesters away in handcuffs. Or both. Lemmy, I said, showing him my screen. Ange pulled my hands lower so she could see too. I was so freaked that I'd forgotten to take her height into account, which is pretty freaked, all right. Ange wasn't kind to people who were oblivious to the world of short people. Time to get out of Dodge, Lemmy said. Yeah, I said, let's go. We looked around, trying to figure out the shortest path out of the protest, starting to feel a little fear. As I scanned the crowd, I saw that I wasn't the only one getting wild-eyed. There were probably lots of other people who'd been tuned into feeds from overhead and noticed the massing horde. I looked back at my phone. Something's weird. Ange yanked my arm down, stared at my phone. Can you be more specific? No, I said. I can't, but something's weird. Lemmy peered intently at my screen. No police UAVs, he said. We all looked up at the airspace over the protest. The density of UAVs, gliders and quadcopters, had definitely fallen off. How do you know it's the police UAVs that are missing? I said. They're the lowest flying, Lemmy said. Better for getting face shots. My mouth had gone dry. Why would they want to ground all their UAVs? Lemmy looked at me with a crazy eye roll. Maybe they don't want to get any video of what's about to happen. Or maybe they're about to do something to the electronics, Ange said. Lemmy and I both looked at her. She had a pit bull look of determination on her face and was digging through her bag. She pulled out two pairs of swim goggles and a stack of paper painter's masks. She pulled one pair of goggles over her eyes and passed the other to me, then used her free hand to produce a quart of milk of magnesia that she used to douse the painter's masks. She put one on, I put one on, and I handed one to Lemmy, but he wasn't paying attention. Instead, he'd crouched down and buried his face in his backpack, and he was all but throwing its contents on the ground as he dug for something. Lemmy, I said, shaking the dripping mask under his nose. The liquid would neutralize some of the sting in any kind of pepper spray, and if they used some other chemical agent, the wet mask would trap more than a dry one. Lemmy! He stood up so fast he caught me on the chin a little and would have sent me backwards on my ass if there'd been room for it. As it was, the people behind me caught me and steadied me, and I waved a quick thanks to them and turned to see Lemmy holding a silver Ziploc bag. "Phones," he said, "quick!" I recognized the bag, a Faraday pouch, the kind of thing you put your ARFID-emitting ID, transit pass, toll road transponder, or passport into if you didn't want strangers to be able to read it. But Faraday pouches weren't just good at keeping the stuff inside from communicating with the outside world. They were also good at keeping radio waves from the outside world from getting inside them. I yanked out my phone so fast I turned my jeans pocket inside out and scattered small change on the ground around our feet. Ange already had hers out. We dropped them in the bag, and Lemmy shoved his in and sealed it and dropped it back in his backpack. Then he took the mask from me and dug out his own goggles and pulled them on. The people around us had seen this weird behavior, and some of them were following us. Others were starting to push and panic, trying to get out, and I thought, oh God, there's going to be a stampede. We're going to die. And at that moment, there was a crack, like the sky was a sheet of paper being torn in two by enormous divine hands, and every electronic device in the vicinity sputtered and died. They'd herfed us. HERF stands for High Energy Radio Frequency, and it basically means a big, nasty pulse of raw radio energy. You can build a HERF gun that will tune the power from a standard car battery, focusing it into a pencil beam of ugly brute force by means of a mini satellite dish, and use it to kill a laptop at 20 paces. The whole thing will cost you under $200 if you're smart about parts. Of course, if you're a big government or well-equipped police force, you don't need to homebrew anything like this. You can just go through a paramilitary mail order catalog and buy some ginormous pulsed energy appliances from off the shelf. From a law enforcement perspective, they're like a friendly nuclear bomb, one that leaves all the people and buildings intact, but preserves that wicked electromagnetic pulse that turns anything more complicated than a 1975 diesel engine into a paperweight. I figured out that the police had herfed the crowd, but that wasn't quite right. Later on, during the hearings on the September 24th protest, police crowd control specialists testified that they aimed the pulse weapon 100 feet over the crowd, instantly killing every UAV in the sky. These plummeted to the crowd below and represented the first wave of casualties for the night. No fatalities, but one person was in a coma for 6 months, and another lost her left eye. The specialists who testified swore that the mobile phones that they took out were unintentional, as were the firmware on all the cars that caught the edges of the burst, and the 6 people whose hearing aids died, and the 12 whose pacemakers stopped, entirely accidental, and most unfortunate. But they had to, quote, preserve operational security, which is police-ese for make sure no one could watch what they did next. And after all, they had given a lawful order to disperse, though I can't say as I heard it. Stuff happens, I suppose. All part of life in the big city. I put my masked mouth right up to Lemmy's ear. Lemmy, yeah? You know that copter we landed on the roof? The one with the low battery? Yeah. You think it's still able to fly? Dunno, maybe. Why? I think you should get it in the sky and start streaming video with infrared right now. Yeah. He broke the seal on the Faraday pouch and spilled out the phones, handing me mine and Ange's, prodding his handset. The cellular towers had all been switched off at SFPD request a moment before the HERF detonated, but Lemmy's phone included a 900 megahertz direct radio link to his UAVs. 900 megahertz was a good frequency, great for penetrating walls and other structures, but it was also a busy band, noisy with baby monitors and walkie-talkies and RC toys. Of course, all of those were pretty much toast at the moment, so Lemmy had the airwaves all to himself. He grunted in satisfaction. "It's up," he said. "Maybe 25 minutes on the battery." A moment later, "It's got 4G, too. Must be picking up towers farther away from us. It's the altitude." "Great," I said. "Get it over us." "Yeah." Ange, meanwhile, was hitting reload, reload, reload on her phone's Wi-Finder, waiting for the moment that the network the copter was retransmitting became available to her. "Got it," she said. "Can you tweet out the URL for the live stream off the copter?" "Derp, what do you think I'm doing?" "Sorry." I had my phone out, too, and signed onto the UAV's network, sent out my tweet. "Can you shut down its network bridge?" I asked Lemmy. "There's going to be a zillion people trying to get online, and none of the video will make it out if they do." Yeah, Lemmy said. Yeah, done. Okay, I said, and looked around for the first time since the pulse. Holy Mother of Zeus. It was as though all the light in the area had been sucked into the earth, leaving us in a realm of shadows. All I could see, for as far as I could make out in every direction, were silhouettes, moving uneasily like stalks of wheat in a gathering storm. Here and there people had found flashlights or headlights, and these created pinpricks of illumination that stood out like searchlights. Then, a wailing sound. A sound I hadn't heard since the day the Bay Bridge blew. It was the San Francisco air raid siren. A sound like an effect from an old war movie. They used to test it every Tuesday afternoon, but after the trauma of its actual use following the attack on the bridge, they'd discontinued the tests. Too many people reacted to the sound with post-traumatic stress freakouts, crying jags and uncontrollable urge to hide or get out of doors or indoors, and various other low-grade psychotic reactions. There'd been a long debate, and finally the city had settled on testing the alarm by playing 3 short beeps, 3 long beeps, and 3 short beeps. Morse code for SOS. But now the siren blared, and it was louder than I remembered, though I couldn't see the nearest PA pole. It was so loud it felt like it was inside my head. So loud it made my teeth clench as it howled up and down its waveform, a sound that every cell in my body knew meant bad stuff is happening. The silhouetted stalks of wheat began to waver more forcefully, colliding with one another as they tried to find some place away from that punishing sound. Suddenly the sound cut off, leaving behind a ringing silence that was almost as scary. Then, an echoing, giant voice broke out over the PA system. It was the voice of pure authority, like something engineered in a lab or coming off a text-to-speech library designed for maximum intimidation and terror.
This is an unlawful gathering.
The words bounced around the precincts of the protests, blocks and blocks of it, like a tasteless parody of the people's mic.
You are subject to search and background checks.
I thought of the copter zipping over our heads, streaming all this live to the web. I wondered how many people were tuned in.
Those who cooperate and who have not broken laws will not be arrested.
There was pushing and shoving from nearby. I looked around and saw that one of the pools of light belonged to a husky protester with a headlamp. He was taking off his baggy coat, revealing a windbreaker emblazoned front and back with block cap letters, SFPD. I looked around from side to side and back and front and saw that there were more SFPD windbreakers coming into view as burly guys dotted around the crowd like raisins in rice pudding revealed themselves. But they weren't the only ones revealing their secret identities. A dozen yards away, a trio of guys in all tactical black, wearing goggles and face masks, arranged in a flying wedge, forced their way through the crowd, knocking people aside as they bulled in a straight line. They snapped to a stop in front of a pair of young guys with scared, pale faces and eyes wide enough to show the whites. With no preamble or wind-up, 2 of the officers stuck them with tasers, and they fell to the ground like stunned oxen, twitching and thrashing. One of them brushed a bystander with his hand, and she screamed, and her head whipped back and hit the nose of the man behind her, which began to gush blood. The 3 guys in the flying wedge took no notice. They knelt down and bound the 2 guys hand and foot with plastic cuffs, cinching the bindings tight with savage yanks, looking like they were trying to start bulky gas mowers, then tossed the guys over their shoulders like rolled-up rugs and bulled their way back out of the crowd. It was around then that the screams and the pushing started. At first it was a distant sound, sounding like it might be a block away, and the pushing was just rippling waves back and forth through the crowd, the person behind me taking a half step back to absorb the shock of the person who'd just taken a half step into her, banging into me, me taking a half step back and colliding with Ange, who steadied me and took a half step back. But the next wave was much stronger, not a half step push, but a step and a half, and I got an elbow in the solar plexus that drove the wind out of me and would have doubled me over if there were room to double over. And the wave after that was like a mosh pit, and the wave after that was like an earthquake, and the wave after that was like, it was like being in a crowd of hundreds of thousands of people where panic had seized the night and was driving us insane.
Then someone had a brilliant idea.
Mic check!
I was irritated at first. Who the hell thought giving a speech at this juncture was going to improve things? But of course, it wasn't about giving a speech. It was about getting through the crowd's animal nature and to its human brain. The part that knew that pushing and shoving was a disaster waiting to happen.
Mic check!
I called back, and others joined it.
Mic check! Mic check!
The call rippled out in concentric circles through the human swarm, and where it was heard, calmness came. A police snatch squad barreled past me, so close I could have stuck out a foot to trip them, but I did nothing, didn't even flinch. There was a calmness descending on me now. That calmness from the temple, the calmness I'd always sought in moments like this, but found so rarely. One of the husky SFPD guys was heading my way, various pieces of gear clipped to his belt, stuff that I found myself eyeing up curiously, despite myself, wanting to know what all those gadgets were about. He stopped a few people away from me, facing a woman and a man who looked like they could have been my parents' friends, the sort they sometimes met for dinner and a show back in the good days. The policeman spoke to them authoritatively, and they both produced IDs. The policeman held up a PDA and snapped a photo of each, the ID briefly illuminated in a grid of red laser light, like a supermarket checkout. He stared at his display for a moment, then put it away. Next, they talked intensely for a few minutes, and then the couple handed over their phones, tapping out their unlock codes first. They must have been in a radio frequency shadow, shielded from the HERF blast, leaving their phones in working order. The officer stared at the cable jacks on the phone's underside for a minute before he pulled out a matching cable and inserted it. The cable ended with one of those intriguing boxes on his belt, and I thought I understood what was going on. The police were checking people, logging them, and copying all the data off their phones before letting them go. I was agog. Somehow this was worse than the snatch squads who'd taken people out of the crowd without so much as a word. Those phones would have so many intimate details of their owners' lives. Passwords, address books of friends and family, GPS logs of all the locations they'd visited, browser logs of all the websites they'd loaded, their IMs, wall updates, tweets. I couldn't believe it. When the officer was done, he took a pen out of a little arm holster and scrawled something on the back of each of their hands. The couple were looking glazed over and horrified. The officer smiled at them and explained something in detail, and they nodded in stunned silence. The officer gave them a friendly slap on the shoulder and pointed, sending them off through the crowd. I moved to intercept them.
"Hey,"
I said.
"Hey, wait."
They stopped.
"What did he say to you?"
"The cop, I mean." The man, about 60, with a friendly face and a neat little mustache and a soft southern accent, said, "He said we could show this to anyone who stopped us, and they'd let us through." He held up his hand, showed me the mark. It looked like a graffiti tagger's mark, a scribble. Maybe it was his initials.
"Special ink," the man said.
"Did he make a copy of your phones?" The woman nodded. She was about the same age, with a good haircut and chunky wooden jewelry around her neck and wrists, like an old hippie, maybe.
"Yeah, and he deleted our photos," she frowned. "I had some pictures of my grandchildren on there."
They both spoke like they were in a dream or a nightmare.
"Thanks," I said.
"Yeah," they said, and moved off. The officer had moved on to someone else. He scanned the ID, took the phone. This time, he searched the guy. The guy was black. Maybe that had something to do with it. The cop searched his bag, his pockets. By then, the guy's phone had locked up again, and the cop made him unlock it. The guy looked like he wanted to cry or hit the cop. The cop was clearly enjoying this. He scribbled on the guy's hand and sent him on his way. Ange and Lemmy had been watching, too. We exchanged horrified looks. Another snatch squad sent a shockwave rippling through the crowd, and this time I did fall over, scraping my palms a little on the ground. The pain seemed to wake me up. I knew what I had to do.
"Mic check!"
I called. Ange gave me an alarmed look.
"Mic check!"
I called again. Ange repeated it. So did Lemmy. The call went around.
"The police are recording IDs and copying the data off your phones and erasing the photos without a warrant, without charges. This is illegal. It's a crime. It's still a crime when the police do it. The police don't get to make up the law as they go."
The officer caught this and looked up at me. I resisted the temptation to speak faster. The people's mic required slow, measured speech. Don't comply! Demand a lawyer! Refuse to allow them to break the law! The cop was moving toward me now, plowing through the crowd, reaching for something on his belt. Pepper spray? A taser? No, a long plastic handcuff strip. I think he's going to arrest me now! For telling you to uphold the law! Think about that! The policeman was close enough to reach out and grab me when a guy stepped out of the crowd and interposed himself between me and him. I only saw his back, a green army surplus parka with a head of long hair protruding from it. He had three earrings in his left ear, two in his right. I saw it all in photographic clarity, limed with the light from the officer's flashlight. The policeman tried to sidestep him, but two more people stepped in his way, then more. I took a step back, and people closed ranks around me. The officer shouted something. No one repeated it. He didn't have the people's mic. You can go now! I don't know what possessed me to say it. It just popped out. You can go now! The crowd repeated it, the sound rippling out. You can go now! It became a chant. You can go now! Four little words. Not, screw you pig, or this is what democracy looks like. Instead, it was a group of people asserting that they were capable of looking after themselves and dismissing the public servant who'd come along to send them off to bed like naughty children. You can go now! The cop stopped. His expression had changed from the confident, condescending friendliness with which he'd addressed the people he'd searched to something between rage and terror. His hand moved toward his belt, which was hung with all sorts of things that had pistol grips or aerosol buttons, non-lethal weapons he could use to shock us, gas us, immobilize us. More people joined the crowd between the cop and me, and I had to stand on tiptoes to see that behind him the crowd had parted, leaving a clear walkway for him to turn around and leave. You can go now! Hundreds of us were chanting it now. We weren't angry anymore. And we weren't laughing, either. There was no mockery in this. We've got this. You're not needed. Go do something else. That's what it meant. You can go now! The cop turned on his heel and walked slowly away, his head held high, chin out, shoulders rigid. Even though he had been on the verge of gassing me a moment before, I felt a moment's pity for him. All he had was authority, and we'd taken that away from him. Now, he was just a man in a kid's dress-up future soldier costume, retreating from the civilians he was supposed to be guardian and master to. A sound is just a shockwave, vibrating at a certain pitch and frequency. In thin air, there aren't many molecules for the shockwave to push ahead of itself, so the sound travels slowly and dies quickly. But in dense substances, steel and stone and water, sound travels fast and for a long, long way, because the shockwave has so much material to work with as it pushes forward and out. We were packed in dense and thick, and our ideas traveled like sound vibrating along a steel beam. You can go now was rippling away from us like rings in a pond. The crowd lurched toward Market Street, one step, two steps. After a day of gathering our numbers and our strength, we were on the march. We were going to go somewhere. Ange twined her fingers with mine, and I threw my arm around Lemmy's neck. We must have looked like Dorothy, the Tin Man, and the Scarecrow setting off down the yellow brick road. Another step. You can go now. And so can we. Another step. I had just a moment's warning. A general commotion, angry shouts, an elbow in the back as the person behind me was shoved forward. And then the snatch squad had me. It was just a confusion of hands at first. Strong hands all over my body. Then a meaty arm put me in a headlock, squeezing hard on my chest, choking so hard I couldn't get a sip of air down my throat. The hands on my arms yanked them behind my back, twisting them painfully in some kind of martial arts come-along hold that made me feel like they would be torn off at the shoulders.
The plastic handcuff bit cruelly into my left wrist, and I'd have screamed if I'd had the breath for it. I thrashed instead, and there was a red-black haze creeping in around the edges of my vision. I registered screaming, Ange, other voices, and was lifted off my feet briefly and shoved this way and then that. And then I was on the ground, gasping for breath, and the hands were gone. Ange was beside me, and she grabbed my goggles and pulled them over my eyes and pulled my mask up over my mouth, her fingers shaking with haste and desperation. I brought my hands up to help her and saw that the plastic cuff was still fastened to my left wrist, but not my right. I levered myself to my feet, feeling like I might retch at any minute. Lemmy was standing beside me, his jacket torn, seeping blood from an ugly swelling bruise on his cheek. He pressed one hand to the wound and gave me a quick thumbs up with the other. "What happened?" I said. "You were de-arrested," Ange said matter-of-factly. I looked around. A guy with wild dreadlocks beside me was wearing what looked like a police-issue gas mask and carrying what was definitely a police-issue riot shield. Behind him, a short woman was wearing a police helmet. A few more police helmets bobbed around the crowd. "What did they do to the cops?" I said. Lemmy shrugged. "Not much. They took their stuff as they retreated. Don't worry, no one beat up a cop or anything." We were still on the march. The crowd took another shuddering step toward Market Street. The mask over my face made it hard to breathe, and my goggles were fogging up. I was just about to clean them when the gas fell. They were dropping it from nearly invisible, nearly silent black aerostats, little toy blimps that used whispering electric motors to keep themselves in place. I'd helped build some at Noisebridge once, a side project of the space program team, who had also launched a lighter-than-air weather balloon with two cameras into the upper atmosphere, snapping pictures of the planet below it, curving away like the ball we knew it to be but could never see. The aerostats were as light and flimsy as a dry cleaner's plastic suit bag. The way they hovered in place was eerie. Prod them with your finger and it would waft away like dandelion fluff, then return to the exact same location with tiny, precise bursts from its little fans. The ones I'd played with had reminded me of jellyfish, and not in a good way. They were like brainless, drifting aliens, and I'd instinctively feared them, like they might have a sting waiting for the unwary. The gas canisters slung under their bellies released their payloads with little near-synchronized pops, popcorn kernels detonating in a pan, and we all looked up at once. Then, panic. The gas had been released from 4 or 5 yards over our heads, far enough up that it formed a drifting cloud that you could actually watch for a moment, which we did, and then as the reality of the falling chemical poison sank in, we all tried to simultaneously hit the ground and run away, anything, to get away from the floating, descending toxin. I was jostled this way and that, knocked to the ground, stamped on. One hard boot landed on my head, another got me in the kidney, dragged to my feet by anonymous hands, shoved, knocked down again, picked up again. Then the choking started, and with it, choked screams, then vomiting. Maybe there was something in the gas to make you puke, or maybe it was its victims' bodies trying desperately to expel the noxious foreign substance from every orifice. I was splashed with puke from all sides, and I slipped in it as I got to my hands and knees, then to my knees, then to my feet. I'd caught some of the gas through my painter's mask, but not much. I was having a little trouble breathing, and my eyes were watering inside my goggles from the irritants that had climbed up my sinuses. I was half blind, and it was dark, and there was only one thing I could think. Ange. I scanned for her, but couldn't find her. A few other people had gotten to their feet, and I heard and then saw quadcopters and gliders start to crisscross the airspace over our heads again. I was sure that they had their night scopes on and were getting lots of footage. I suppose they'd be able to get nice, long, clear pictures of anyone who showed up with goggles and masks. Troublemakers who'd come expecting that the police would deploy chemical agents against them for having an opinion. I called Ange's name through my mask, and it came out muffled, and when I breathed deep to shout louder, I caught a mouthful of the chemicals clinging to the mask's outside, sucked through its pores and around its sides, and doubled over coughing, swallowing hard to keep from vomiting. I did not want to vomit into my mask, and I did not want to take my mask off and show my face. I started grabbing the people on the ground around me and helping them to their feet.
I had no idea where Ange was, but if she was one of those people thrashing in their own vomit on the ground, I hoped that someone was helping her up. I reached for a big guy with a short military brush cut who was holding his head and groaning, and something stopped me, rooted me to the spot with an irrational icicle of fear stabbing me right in the spine. I squinted at the man, and then it hit me, an ugly gnarl of scar tissue that ran from the crown of his head to his thick neck. I'd seen it before, in the back of an all-black luxury car whose back doors had no handles. It was Knothead, the Ziz Goon.